three, two, one, and we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with another episode of the Bedroom to Boardroom podcast, where we delve into the stories of people from underrepresented backgrounds. The focus is always the guest, but I'm the host for today's episode, AJ. So without further ado, let's get started.
Today we have two interesting guests, co-founders and founders of CoinRule. Gentlemen, I'd love to learn a little bit more about CoinRule. I'd love to for you guys to introduce yourselves.
Hi guys, it's Gabriel here, Gabriel Muzella, co-founder and CEO of CoinRule. A little bit about CoinRule. CoinRule is a smart assistant for cryptocurrency traders. We help people build automatic strategies and then run them on your favorite exchange.
Hi, and I'm Oleg Kiberstein. I'm also co-founder and CEO of CoinRule.
So, how did you two get into cryptocurrency? That's probably the most pressing first question that comes to people's minds.
Yeah, for me, it was in 2012. I was in Boston working, it was at MIT first, when I heard first Bitcoin. And then I went to Northeastern University to work there in a research lab. And and I just started playing around with Coinbase and I bought some Bitcoin. And that's how I got into it. And then I sold them and I got a very good 6%, 6% increase and gain that was very low at that time. Sure. And then I went back in 2016. I went back just to check my Coinbase account and I saw that there was another coin, Ethereum. And then I just started buying, and I found myself in the 2016 bubble, and then when actually I made quite good returns, and that's when I got in love with cryptocurrencies, and then I went down to study blockchain, decentralization, DLTs, and all the fundamentals of the new finance that is about to come.
And in my case, so I was always interested in, like, let's say, the concept of private currencies, decentralized banking, etc. And I was coming out of a job in the banking industry. So I had been working at Citibank in London. I had quit to build my first startup and suddenly found myself with more opportunity to really engage in the tech community and started going to events, started to talk to people about it. And at some point, it just clicked, it blew my mind, and I couldn't stop reading everything about crypto, talking to people, writing about it, and here I am still 3-4 years later, still in the space.
So one thing I found in articles trying to research both of you was a direct quote where you say, decentralization and tokenization will revolutionize the way by which we manage personal finances, as well as the way we buy and sell any assets. How did you come to that consensus? That's a direct quote as well. I'm paraphrasing.
what was the quote? Was it mine or all?
Yeah, quote? That was yours.
Oh, it's mine. Okay, wow. That's cool. No, I mean, I really believe in that, actually. The concept that, the digital industry brought first was actually no more middlemen, direct, consumer to business relations. And now that's happening also in finance and in banking. The idea that you need to give money to someone and then you need to actually go to the ATM machine to get cash out and pay someone because you are getting back your own money, that has always been absurd for me. Now, an absurd concept. I'm paying someone to keep my money with them and then I cannot access them. So with the decentralization and blockchain, potentially everyone will have a bank in their pockets. Everyone can have their own wallet. They can connect their own wallet to whatever device, infrastructure, platform, or banks they want. And they can actually plug in and trade their money, or they can actually do any transaction. That's also the case with the blockchain. It's all transparent. So it will be not just the evil banks controlling your data and having actually an overview of what's really happening in the world, but everyone will have view of what's happening in terms of flows of money going left and right around the globe. In terms of decentralization as well, that's just a need because the first internet was built on centralized database, and now we got these 4 or 5 giants colonizing all the aspects of our privacy and our data life. With decentralization, basically, internet will be invincible, and it will be much more resilient, especially nowadays where a cyber attack, a cyber war could be just like, you know, as normal as a pandemic. So decentralization will bring that into play. And there are also the concept of the new DeFi world coming on. They are also very interesting. But it's good that we are kind of decomposing, destructuring the world of finance as a young generation, as the millennials. And now we are rebuilding step to step. So a lot of times, when I talk with some colleagues in the crypto space, they come and, you know, they discovered something like, you know, they say like, oh, look, I have this new account. People can put money in and then we do this and we do that and we give them back 2% every month. And I was like, yes, that's what's called usually a saving account. So sometimes they just come back and they invent the same stuff, but they add a little bit of a twist on it. Or sometimes they just invent a new model, a new mechanism that really helps people managing the money.
So one of the main concerns, I guess, people have with the notion of us moving to maybe a cashless society is the fear that your governments, the dictators, so to speak, could restrict your cash flow, restrict your access to finance. And Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in general is somewhat of a solution to this problem based upon its decentralized nature. What's actually very interesting to see is where, you know, the stock markets have been taking a pounding, like oil reached its lowest since I think it's ever been in its history. And if we look at like Bitcoin, for example, we're actually seeing some stability over the last like 14 or so days in its actual value. Do you think there's any correlation between the two?
Let me respond to that. I would say to some extent, yes, absolutely. I think if at this point of its life, Bitcoin would not be standing up as a somewhat decorrelated asset compared to traditional markets, we would really have to wonder if it's really serving the purpose that it was designed to be, a form of digital gold. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is this is Bitcoin was invented at the high point of the last financial crisis. This is the first time that Bitcoin and also, of course, other cryptos are going through really a huge new crisis. So to see how they will hold up was a big question mark. Today, like roughly a bit more than 10 years after Bitcoin was created, we're still at the stage of its life where it's seen by most of the market as a risk asset. Mm-hmm. And in a financial crisis, people get rid of their risk assets and hold cash. They hold US dollar, etc. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a bit of that. I mean, obviously, the price of Bitcoin in mid-March dropped from like around 8,000 to about 4,000, 5,000 briefly. What happened was that just everyone panicked. I mean, even gold at the time actually crashed. What was important was to see the recovery of it. And that's exactly what you said. Actually, Bitcoin has bounced back relatively well. And just even as oil was taking an absolute thrashing yesterday, Bitcoin was actually holding its price levels. So that's extreme. Like for me, this is a very, very positive long-term sign that there is a recognition in the market that Bitcoin is becoming a form of digital gold.
So in terms of like adoption, so most, you can't quite mention it, millennials tend to be the earliest demographics to adopt to new ways by which we engage, interact with the world. I've been fortunate enough to have friends who, essentially all my knowledge of cryptocurrency came from Reddit. And I learned about cryptocurrency relatively early. And I was fortunate enough in that 2015 or 2016-17 bubble to invest not only in crypto, into Bitcoin and Ethereum, also into some other tokens, preferably ETH20. And I managed to make, I put, let's say, 10 or so thousand pounds in, and I made a nice return, of which, you know, I splurged most of it like an idiot, like young 20-something-year-old would. But it was quite interesting to me to see how I could, in essence, take this money that I've earned in a formal employment, put it into somewhere online, and then in 6 months, I see a crazy return, probably more aggressive return than I would see in a stock market. So the question I have, I guess, is when do we see wider adoption from millennials and then ultimately the boomer generation? Do you see that being something that's happening within maybe the next 5 or so years?
I think it will take time. It's like there's like few elements. So the first element is actually when we talk about millennials, actually now millennials are old. So it's like people between 30 to 40 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's good. It's good news because, you know, they actually use fintech product because they actually have savings now. So that's good. So now the new generation, the younger one, they will start probably using some sort of tokens or coins applied to some video games, applying to some other like software that is being developed on the new web. So you know, with the kitties, with the Ethereum kitties, and other programs like that, mm-hmm. or for example, with the coins that you can use in Fortnite. You can actually see that's happening. So, but I think to reach that level where several coins will be used in almost all the services online, we need at least 10 to 20 years. It's really, you know, if you think about the internet took like 40 years to actually pervade all our aspects of life. I think finance as well, it will take at least another 20 years to kind of go everywhere. But then you will start thinking about coins that are interoperable between them, you know, each other. And you can basically trade also across platforms, across blockchains, and it will all be compatible. That's an element that will come as well. But it will take time.
So I think
just maybe to just quickly to add to that point, there will be different cycles of adoption. And they will most likely also happen differently than we expected. For example, I was just reading the other day, they are the first corporate bonds being issued on the Ethereum blockchain. So you can check, you have traders checking on their Bloomberg terminals for corporate bonds issued on Ethereum. Like that's not something like if this had happened in 2017, the price of Ethereum would have jumped to, you know, 5,000. Everyone would have gone crazy. Today this happens, people don't really notice it. So it's kind of like it's happening slowly. And I think most of the adoption is, let's say, it's still far from really reaching retail because too much of the interfaces are still very complex. That's actually something we're trying also to address with CoinRule. It's really still complex products. Now, what's happening is that a lot of the stuff out there now today is purely financial. So you have DeFi, for example. You have a small group of really like coders of some funds. They know how to navigate those markets. And a lot of it, we don't even really have an idea yet of what kind of things will ultimately be built on it. So when the internet was created, no one would have predicted that Facebook and mobile phone apps will drive massive adoption. And I think a lot of it will be similar in this space. There will be things that will drive adoption. We are not even thinking about them just yet.
Sure. So in terms of traffic, I probably preference this by explaining a little bit more about why my question is coming to play. So I have some family who are, you know, internationally based in Africa, Nigeria, and Ghana, to be exact, and in Kenya also. And there was MPay, which was a method by which people could send payment across Africa for goods and services. And we're seeing, like, my cousin right now has a cryptocurrency platform who... Why they are set up and running is the lack of access to bank accounts for the majority of users. So the question I would ask is, are we seeing earlier adoption in different parts of maybe the world? Are we seeing any regional correlations, or are we just seeing, generally speaking, like slow adoption like globally?
Alec?
Yeah, sure. So one thing I would say, there's definitely a lot of regional differences. Mm. I remember like 2 years ago, I was traveling in Southeast Asia, and people that I would meet in places like Singapore, Indonesia, had a significantly more natural understanding of the concept of cryptocurrencies. Mm. Like when I speak with people in the UK, when I speak with people in Western Europe, there's still a lot of these like doubts and what is this magic internet money? Whereas countries where people still remember what it's like to have volatile fiat currencies in their own country, or places where people just don't really rely on the currency you know, being around in, let's say, 5 to 10 years' time. For them, it's much more normal that there will be changes in, let's say, currency systems, also payment systems. Now, what we are seeing at CoinRoo right now, for example, is a lot of our users are coming from places like Brazil, Nigeria, Indonesia, Turkey, where people are aspirational. People don't necessarily have the same access to investment opportunities as someone in London or New York has. And we actually, we are loving this trend. Like, this is really, this is a technical revolution that potentially is not just being driven by, let's say, Silicon Valley, but it's actually has the potential to be genuinely global. You have crypto companies coming up from every corner of the world. And that's, for me, like, one of the most exciting parts of what's going on here.
Awesome. So, as cryptocurrency founders, with this coronavirus situation taking place, I'd like to ask you two questions. One, how are you two finding remote working, especially being a tech-based platform? And secondly, are we seeing any differences to maybe usual transactions or going through the platform based upon this current pandemic?
Well, for us, it's actually a great time because, funny enough, people is at home. People are doing a lot of paperwork, admin work, and they happen also to trade. So in the last 2 months, we had an increment of 30% in terms of traffic. We had many more signups. People are buying paid plans. So we're actually growing very well in this last 2 months. And so it's very good news for us. And then in terms of remote working, our team is very international. So we have an headquarter in London, and then we have a tech team based in Czech Republic because our third co-founder, Zdeněk, CTO, he sits there. He was in London and now he's in the nice city called Pilsen. That is actually the city where they make the nice beer, the Pilsner. So he's there. He doesn't drink too much, but he's building. he has a very nice tech team down there. And then we have also two employees, one in Ukraine, one in Lithuania. So in essence, we all always work remotely since when we started. So for us, really, the way we work hasn't changed a lot. We have stand-ups, you know, we have proper agile process every morning. We meet in the chat, everyone. We have product planning on Tuesday. So we have our ceremonies, you know, during the week with our team. And then we already have all the processes for remote working. So to be honest, I mean, I would say, like, really, the crisis hasn't affected too much in, the company. Actually, the numbers are going up. So in that regard, yeah, the virus was a good thing.
I like that. Another question I'd like to ask is, so quite typically we have, you know, young people with these amazing business ideas, and they tend to struggle with the technical execution of them, i.e. like being like myself, maybe you have an amazing idea, and you don't have the technical know-how to do so. How did you, first of all, I know all three of you met at a mass challenge, but how did you know that maybe, you know, your CTO was a CTO for you? And how did you, all three of you, realize that, hey, like, we complement each other and we have the correct skill sets to take CoinRoo from ideation to market and much, much further beyond?
Okay, that's a big question. We can talk here for like a few days probably about that. So I mean, you know, usually what no one really says in the startup world is that you know, it's you need a lot of luck. You need to be lucky to actually meet the right co-founders. There are not many out there. So there's a lot of people that want to do projects, side project. But then when it's actually the time to jump off and say, like, yeah, leave your 9-to-5 job and come full time to the startups, and maybe the startup is not yet well funded, then a lot of people drop off and it's like, oh, wait, I was joking. Or maybe they don't want to put money down to start, you know, a company. So that's actually, meeting a co-founder is the hardest thing, more than meeting the love of your life, probably. Yeah, and wow. And that also means that finding a good CTO, it's almost impossible. So CTOs are super requested nowadays. So when you find one, it's just a trial and error. You can have, you know, a few months where you try each other to build the first mock-up or MVP, and that already tells you, you know, where is the commitment if you match as a co-founder. So that is not really the right answer. The only thing is just if you are a non-technical founder, it's your job to actually bring the money in the company. So don't expect some tech guy to work for free for you for 6 months, 1 year. So you actually need to pay him. And then on top of that, maybe he can get a cut on his wage, and then give, you know, you can give him some equities, and then eventually can become your CTO. So basically, the burden of the start in terms of financial, in terms of finding the right people, is on the non-technical founder that can take care of the business and marketing, and then the CTO will follow, because the CTO wants to see your commitment. He wants to see mm-hmm. your part of work in terms of financial projection, in terms of mocking up the first design, in terms of user research, getting the feedback. And when he's seen all that humus of work, then he actually, you know, you can convince him to join you, you know, with a very low salary, with equities, and then he will start working with you. But just like I see a lot of young people that never did any an entrepreneurial journey, to actually come in and say to tech people, why don't you work for me for 6 months on this project without having done then homework first? And that's typical, that doesn't work.
I mean, you just described me to some degree.
And just to add from our own story, so it's also quite interesting, because so I had left my job to start my first startup. I was initially, we were two business founders, mm-hmm. Then eventually found a friend who joined as a CTO, joint Mass Challenge. And then, as you said, in Mass Challenge, Gabriele, Stenek, and myself, the three of us met. And each one of us has a different story of, I know Gabriele has a story of how I was chasing him for the first few months of the program, because I wanted to kind of talk to him about a few things. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Zdenek and me, we actually became friends. He had just moved to London for the Mass Challenge program. He literally arrived in London with £50 in his pocket. Never been to London before. He was living in a hostel. He was basically writing code for that hostel to stay mm-hmm. there for free. So proper hustler. Wow. And all of us were doing other projects. And actually, Zdenek was at one point asking me to join him as a marketing co-founder. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped my first company. And then with Gabriele, we started CoinRoo. And then we asked later Zdenek to join us. So it's been, you know, it's been really a journey. Like there's mm-hmm. been so much back and forth before we really all came together.
And actually, before Zdenek, we had two other co-founders. So there is like a bit of story mm-hmm. there as well.
So we tend to see
a relationship that didn't work well.
So let's spend some time on that. So founder fallouts, especially in those early stages. So without going into too much detail, because I think privacy is relatively important. Those two earlier CTOs, why didn't they work?
So what happened? Okay. The first one was I will say he had like other plans, and he was more focused. He was very young. He was 22. He was very, very smart, very talented, but he had some conflict of interest, and also he didn't have enough time for us, because mm-hmm. he was doing other things at the same time. So that's a typical scenario. That was the first one. Then the second one was basically someone that we started paying as a tech lead, and we wanted him to become a CTO, but actually he never became. And then we also had, actually, I just forgot, we also had another guy that is a friend of mine, very nice guy, but he only lasted 1 month, because, again, he had a super well-paid consultant job in a big mm-hmm. bank, and then he wanted to do some startup. After a month, he realized that he cannot really leave that very lucrative contract mm-hmm. to come with us for 1 year with no income. So, you know, there's always that moment. And even among ourselves, you know, the way we switched from a well-paid monthly cash flow to mm-hmm. to the actual full-time startup work, it was not so easy. It was also, you know, I think I was the first, then Oleg was the second, and we had like a big chat about it. I don't know if you, Oleg, remember.
Yeah, for sure. Because we had a big opportunity to join an accelerator that was giving us some money, but obviously there you know, it's a big decision to make at that point, because it wasn't really enough money to carry us too far, but there was the possibility for follow-up funding.
Sure.
So there was kind of the trade-offs to evaluate there.
Well, I remember we kind of held an emergency meeting, something at like 11 p.m., 11 o'clock at night in a pub, me and him, to discuss about this.
Yes.
It was a very, very interesting time. And then after that, also Janek came time, yeah.
So yeah. Regards to friends and business, so friends as co-founders, and it doesn't quite work out. How did that conversation go? How's that relationship apologies been since? Because I've had this issue before where you have, you know, a Merida team who you're working on alongside with a project. Things are going well, you're getting traction. Now it's the time when you realize, oh, wow, this is actually commercially viable. Now we need to kind of, you know, focus on, you know, saving some of our income from our 9-to-5 job and funnel it into this. And times of friends, they haven't necessarily had that commitment, and it's just led for very difficult, awkward conversations. And in most cases, the relationships have been, you know, strained as a result.
I mean, the lucky part with us was that we were already, we met as a startup people. Mm-hmm. You know,
we met. Always a bit shocked that people still listen to me. Anyway, that's the end of part one. Stay tuned where we'll be dropping episode 2 or part 2 in a few days.